That was Nightmare by Artie Shaw. Some noir to get you in the mood for our retro Melbourne crime special tonight here on 2SER's book show, The Final Draft. I'm Genevieve McGregor.
And I'm Netta Vanavak. And tonight we have a couple of books that are both more why done it than who done it, set among the mean streets of working class Melbourne. But that is where the similarities end. We're starting off in 1933 with The Richmond Conspiracy by Andrew Grimes, which begins, as all good crime novels should, with a ruthless businessman found dead in a warehouse.
Next up, we have an interview with Peter Tohig, winner of this year's Ned Kelly Award for Crime Fiction, for his novel The Cartographer. In this story, an 11-year-old boy who witnesses a murder relies on the bravado of superhero comics and detective stories as a guide for survival on the run from a killer who's seen his face.
And finally, I chat with American author Morgan Callan Rogers, whose first novel is set among the close-knit fishing communities of northeastern America. All that coming up, so stay tuned.
Find out what's really making the world tick. The Wire, weekdays at 6 p.m.
It's the Depression era, circa 1933, in Melbourne. Australians in their thousands were sent to war against Germany, and many are not coming back. Meanwhile, the summer of cricket is on, and Australia is thrashed by the UK in what was termed the Bodyline scandal. The incident angered Australians and signalled the demise of the British Empire.
In Sydney, the bridge is about to be opened, but protests are gathering against it, and an angry group called the New Guard is leading the charge. It's against this backdrop of conflicting violent events that the crime takes place in Andrew Grimes' latest novel, The Richmond Conspiracy. Reporter Anne-Marie Reyes did some investigating and finds out what inspired the novel.
Mr. Langer just cut the ribbon. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people on the harbour, I can see from here.
As the controversy that surrounded it extended beyond the boundaries of the cricket pitch and into international politics.
It was at this point in the game that Woodfull was unfortunately struck on the heart by a ball from...
The details are complicated, but it began with the Australian captain, Bill Woodfull, being struck in the chest by Larwood.
I think that particular period of history is a fascinating one. It's a time of great change. It's a time when Australia is shrugging off the imperial influence, if you like. It's also a time when there was a great questioning of morality and of authority that was as a result of the carnage of the First World War. The death toll, as you would know, of course, was horrific in that particular war. And I think there was a sense that the old order was under threat. It was obvious the ruling class, if you like, had seriously misled the people and done a terrible job of prosecuting the war. And I think there was a great sense in which people felt that they'd been let down by their leaders. So there was a questioning of authority. There was a feeling in Australia, I think, with a lot of people that Britain had really had let us down. And of course, with the Bodyline series, the English coming out here and attempting to win that test series basically at all costs, I think people really did feel a very strong sense the British Empire was no longer what it was. There was that the period of the Great Depression with so many people out of work and the rise of the right-wing groups in Australia and of course in Sydney, as you would know, the New Guard was the most prominent of these, and they were the group that actually disrupted the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But there were other groups as well in Australia.
Andrew Grimes says he deliberately wanted to take the events away from the city, and he's quite familiar with rural Australia as he grew up in Gippsland, Melbourne. Besides the novel, an introduction to the landscape of the regions, it's also taken him almost a lifetime to write the novel.
First came to me about 30 years ago, that's right. Pretty slow in getting it together, but I guess I didn't really get serious about writing it until about 5 years ago.
And how much of the content and the plot in that book, the narrative, for example, is based on real experience?
Look, I'd say it's very fictional. I mean, obviously the Bodyline was something that happened, and I make references to specific events during the course of the match, because during the actual narrative story as it unfolds at that particular time in mid-January, the third test is being played in Adelaide. So I kind of refer back to what's happening in the test match at that particular time. Really, it is a work of fiction.
It's been described, for example, by Peter Corris as a perfect novel for police procedural. Do you have an insider knowledge of police procedures that you've actually adapted inside the content of your novel?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's funny you should say that. I've had a few people have actually asked me whether I've been a policeman, and in fact, one bloke who's an ex-army guy is convinced that I was in the army. Well, I've neither been in the army nor in the police, but, you know, I mean, I guess the function of a novelist is to create a real world.
The setting of place and time, all conflictive, made way for a stronger narrative for a crime whodunit with Grimes' Richmond conspiracy. Another strong protagonist in his story are the Praetorian Guards.
The Praetorian Guard is an invention of mine, but nevertheless there were groups like that in Australia at the time, and it's rumoured that Tom Blamey, who was the Chief Commissioner of the Victoria Police at the time, was in fact a prominent member of a right-wing group.
Rise of right-wing groups. Do you think that perhaps if you actually started writing that novel at this period of time, it would almost be like those groups could be considered as terrorists, because we are worried about these groups at this day and time in Australia?
Yes, I think that's probably true, but I think that there was an ineptitude about those groups, I think. And the New Guard, for example, the one which we know the most about, was very short-lived and it was very easily discredited, I think. So I don't think that there was quite the same danger in that group as perhaps we might be concerned about now.
You don't think that it was quite controversial when they disrupted the official opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge?
It was. I wouldn't call it an act of terrorism. As I say, I think they were fairly inept, really, and I think there were an awful lot of people who were swept up by it, who quickly repented of it, of their association with that group.
And make it seem real, did he ever. The crime novel revolves around the murder of Victor Radcliffe, a businessman from old wealth and an ex-war veteran like most of the characters in the novel. It soon unfolds. Victor is not popular among his own family, football friends, business colleagues, and even his distant wife, who shared the palatial home with him. As with any whodunit story, the trick is to create a maze of plots that you just can't put down the book. There were many false clues, and the real murderer was a real revelation, closer than any would think. The strength of his narrative are his protagonists, and you got drawn deeper into the world of each character as slowly you find out who committed the crime. Character Senior Detective James McLean also served in the war and came back with a permanent limp, and he's the detective to dig each motives by the suspects. Where did Andrew Grimes get his inspiration in creating the twists and turns and choosing the right characters? TV programs like Law and Order or CSI, perhaps? Andrew Grimes explains.
I'm not that enamoured of all this kind of, the CSI stuff that you see on TV, which is all driven by forensics.
Yes.
I find it a bit tedious, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, what interests me is characters and motivation, why people do what they do. So I prefer to hark back to another era, if you like, where the detective is reliant upon understanding people and what motivates them. As a matter of fact, I did attempt to get some sort of sense of police history, and I found that the Victoria Police weren't that cooperative. They just said to me, oh yeah, there's a book you can read, and, which I did. And I found it interesting, but it wasn't really that enlightening, really. And I had an idea of what technology was available. I've attempted to clothe it in authenticity by referring back to the period and to try and create some sense of reality about it. But in the end, it stands or falls as an entertainment.
There is fear aspects about, suspense, because it took a while before you found out who the suspects could be. There is also an interesting aspect that you actually use sexuality and sex. You had clues with the slain victims who had shaven pubic areas. Where did that idea come from?
This is a pretty silly story, but anyway, I'll share it with you. When I was about 15 at high school, our entertainment was to, and this is going back a long time, you understand, our entertainment was to get hold of a copy of the Truth newspaper and read what was called the Heart Balm, right? This is where people used to write in with problems and, someone would solve them for them. One particular thing that was written about was a woman who'd written in to say how she'd inadvertently glimpsed her daughter naked and had noted that her body had been shaved, her pubic area had been shaved, and she questioned her daughter about this, and her daughter attempted to make light of it, but in the end she broke down and said how this was part of her husband's fetish and he insisted on her, shaving her body, and she was quite upset and distressed about it. For some reason or other, that's just stuck in my mind.
And on that note, before I give it all away, the shaven pubic region was actually a device in the writing, which I'll leave for you to find out for yourself. Andrew Grimes is writing another novel, and yes, Senior Detective James McLean will be in it again.
Anna-Marie Reyes there, speaking to Andrew Grimes, author of the book The Richmond Conspiracy.
Do you remember what life was like when you were 11?
This year's winner of the Ned Kelly Award for Crime Fiction, The Cartographer, is written from the perspective of an 11-year-old boy. His name is never revealed, but his reflections about the murder he witnessed and his dysfunctional family are enchanting, dark, and laugh-out-loud funny.
So how does an 11-year-old deal with grown-up problems? With the streetwise slang and wise guy cracks of Melbourne 1959, where the story is set, as well as the bravado of the superhero comics and the detective stories he uses as a guide for survival. He also creates a map to help him navigate his way around trouble, but not everything goes to plan, as author Peter Tohig explained to 2SER's Jackie Lee.
It's about a child who witnesses a murder and he becomes a bit paranoid. He, out of sheer terror, he decides that he will make a map of the area that he lives in so that he won't accidentally go that way again, because he has this idea that the murderer would hang around that area. So he makes a map. And he becomes obsessed with this map, and the whole book is about the troubles he gets into while he's actually creating this map. There's generally the theme of change in the book, because he starts off at the very beginning of the book. He's in a terrible state. He's lost his twin brother, and he doesn't know what to do. He hasn't been allowed to experience grieving in the normal setting. The grieving setting, because his family has completely shut down about the whole thing. So at the beginning of the book, we see a child who's been deeply wounded, who doesn't know what to do about that, and at that point the novel begins, and we see him witness this terrible crime, and that only makes matters worse. From that point on, he can only, in a sense, he can only get better or completely fail. And so we see him try to make sense of what's going on around him and in his life and in his head, and in the people around him, some of which are pretty nasty people. So he undergoes change as a result of all of these pressures, as you would, as anybody would. It's just that his way of undergoing change is not something that he has a lot of control over. Although he tries to exert control, he does his best, but he doesn't really succeed very well.
What's it like writing a novel from the perspective of an 11-year-old boy?
Well, it wasn't so hard, given that I was an 11-year-old boy for a while. It was actually fun. It was actually quite fun, because I got to revisit the times, even though I didn't have a really clear memory of what it was like to be 11. I got to revisit the times and some of the areas that I did remember, so I was able to put together, you know, the illusion that I was, you know, an 11-year-old boy.
Crime is just one of the many themes covered in The Cartographer. From the perspective of an 11-year-old boy, it sort of highlights the way adults and children react to life events and the differences between them. What made you want to explore this?
I think it's a very interesting thing, you know, that difference that you just mentioned. And I wanted to explore the way a child might have to cope with the experiences that an adult might normally might have to cope with, but that a child would normally not have to cope with. So his way of coping is that he has a personality change, and that's the thing I wanted to explore in the novel, how a child might undergo a personality change in order to cope with his unusual way of interfacing with the adult world, because he sees a lot of things, he hears a lot of things that a child would not normally hear and see, and it's partly because of the kind of family he lives in and the kind of place he lives in, but he has to find some way to cope with that as a child. So what he does is he undergoes a personality change in a way. It's a psychological problem for him, and he solves it. He solves it by becoming a superhero.
Why is cartography so prominent in this novel?
The original idea wasn't to feature cartography at all, but just to feature the child's activity, you know, that the fact that he makes maps. The whole book became a map. I became quite conscious of this after a while, that I was creating a map out of the book. So that's why it's such a rich, convoluted kind of book. It's a labyrinthine kind of book, and it's because the book itself has that characteristic of a map. And I just find it a fascinating concept, the concept of cartography. I read some books on it before while in the course of writing this book. I found it really fascinating. I can see why a child would become interested in cartography, because it gives him a structure that he may not have. In fact, this child doesn't have a strong structure at all for handling anything. He comes from a dysfunctional family, lives in a dysfunctional place. So this is his way of, well, it's one of his ways of coping. The other way, of course, is to create himself as a series of characters, superhero characters, which hasn't worked too well for him, actually, but that's what he does.
And he's got that superhero character, but there's also a lot of streetwise, wise guy slang in this book.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy using that kind of language and description when writing this?
I did, because I actually had some family members when I was that old who used that kind of slang, and so I'd heard it before, and I remembered the words. So it was easy to slip them in and to give them to the child, and that wasn't my original intention when I started writing the book. It's just that his character suddenly developed out of nowhere, and he became this slang-using child. And the reason he uses the slang, of course, in the book is because he hears it all around him. He hears it from mainly his grandfather and his grandfather's pretty nasty mate, who he likes, actually.
This book is set in Melbourne, 1959.
Mm.
What made you choose that particular time period?
Well, originally, I was going to set it in the suburbs in 1959. And when I first got the idea for the book, that was where I had it. I didn't really give a lot of thought to it until I started writing, and then I suddenly realized, well, the time was something that I had decided before I started writing the novel, because I thought that was an interesting time, because it was a time when there weren't many restrictions on what children did, so I thought I'd explore that. But then when I started writing the novel, immediately I realized that the suburbs weren't half as dangerous and nasty as the inner suburbs. So that's where I decided to place it. So that's why he has access to all of these dark lanes and drains, which he likes. Because there aren't any drains in the suburbs. At least I didn't see any when I lived in the suburbs. But in the city, of course, that sort of stuff is everywhere. And in the 50s, there would have been pretty much free access to it. So the child goes into this pretty metaphorical kind of journey, but he goes into the underworld of Richmond, and that's where he has a lot of his time, spends a lot of his time. Not hiding, but just exploring.
What's that?
Don't you know?
Huh?
To SER. You're listening to 2SER 107.3 and streaming on the web at 2SER.com.
Florian Gillam is just another 12-year-old living with her parents in a fishing village on the coast of Maine in the northeastern United States. Her father is a lobsterman and her mother a waitress, and the three of them are happy, Florian and her friends running wild in the woods and along the windswept coast. But during the summer of 1963, Florian's young mother Carly vanishes, and Florian and her grief-stricken father try to move on, haunted by the mystery of what's happened to her.
This is a coming-of-age novel written by first-time novelist Morgan Callan Rogers, who traces Florian's adolescence as she butts up against her father's girlfriend Stella and leans on her friends. She's a pig-headed and feisty young heroine who leaps off the page, and when Netta called Morgan at her home in South Dakota, she asked her just where on earth Florian came from.
I got the idea for the book from a letter to the editor in a local paper, and I decided to write a story about the writer of the letter, and she was an adult at that time, and the voice just came to me immediately. It was one of those gifts that writers wish that they could have all of the time. And it was like sitting across the table from her and having endless cups of tea while she talked and told her story.
What does adult Florian sound like?
That's a good question. She sounds like a Florian who's had a bit of a hard time in her life, but is still undaunted and is willing to tell her story, loves to tell her story.
What was her letter to the editor?
Oh, the letter to the editor. She lived in a trailer by the side of the road, and she had lawn ornaments of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and someone had stolen a dwarf. And she was writing and telling people that they were really kind of outraged about it, and that the dwarfs and Snow White meant a lot to her family. Her children had played with those dwarfs when they were younger, and they'd been with them for a very long time. And she ended the letter by saying, "If you see Sneezy the dwarf..."
Sneezy.
I know, please. That's what got me. Sneezy, why not Doc or Dopey, one of the better known dwarfs.
But Sneezy is a very underrated dwarf, I think.
Well, yeah, he is. That's why I was surprised that somebody took Sneezy. Maybe somebody with compassion, you know.
It It's nice to know that Florine lives on beyond the version of herself that we read in the book. But I wanted to ask you about Maine, because the place there seems second only to Florine in terms of its importance to the story. And I guess I wanted to know what it was about fishing communities or coastal communities that have given them such a solid presence. It's almost different to any other place in a way.
Well, the Maine coastal communities are some of the oldest communities along the East Coast in the United States. The fishing villages have been there for generations and generations. And, you know, one lobsterman passes down his line of trap to his sons or his daughters. And this has been going on since the 1700s. Of course, they were isolated before Maine was settled and had a lot of small towns along the roads. But that's where they lived. They lived along these little points. And they still live along these little points that reach out into the Atlantic Ocean. And some of the houses are 200 years old, 300 years old. It's just a very, very old tradition. And it's romantic because it's on the sea and it's beautiful and the weather is crazy and it's wild. And, you know, it's just it's a very unique place.
As someone who doesn't know what the Maine accent sounds like or what the dialect sounds like, it really seems as though you've nailed it. I mean, there's expressions there that come out from the side and knock you off your feet. They're so funny and peculiar. And I wondered how important it was for you to be able to nail that dialect in order to convey who it was that Florine is.
Well, two things about the dialect. That's broad, and it does sound funny, and a lot of people laugh at the accent. And there are a lot of sayings that are accredited to Mainers that are kind of cliche. And what I wanted to do was not to use the cliches at all, but I did want an honest dialect from the people that I grew up with. So that's what I worked on doing, and it was really important that it was genuine.
How much did your training as an actress influence that rhythm that you really get when they're bantering back and forth, or slinging insults as it might be?
Huge, huge. I did a lot of improv when I was an actress. I did, of course, a lot of plays. So you learn about timing, you learn about rhythm, you learn about length of sentences, you learn about pauses, you learn about motivation, and it's sort of like da, 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 da. It's like a tennis match, just tossing things over the net.
Florine's mother disappears and she spends the rest of her adolescence trying to come to terms with that. And was it difficult for you to avoid veering into the mystery of that disappearance? Because it's really more background to Florine's adolescence than anything else.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people want to know what happened to the mother. I'm sure you do too.
Well, I almost don't, you know. It's well, almost better not to know, I think, because I imagine it would be something shapeless and horrible.
Yeah, well, I knew what happened to her when I wrote the book. As an author, I needed to know. But I wrote the book because I wanted to explore what it was like for the hundreds of thousands of people in the world. And I know a few of them personally who have someone who has gone missing and they've never heard from them again. And how horrible that just must be with no closure. I wanted to write it from the viewpoint of an adolescent because that's a rocky road in itself. So with that added on to Florine's adolescence, that's what I wanted to dig into and explore. I just wanted to get one person's viewpoint on what went on. And actually, I guess I got a few viewpoints because it also affected the father very deeply.
Tell me about writing for such a young character. I mean, how do you walk that line of writing for someone who's experiencing all of that turbulent grief in adolescence and whose worldview is going to naturally be limited to catering for an adult readership who can see more than she can?
Well, she's my age. She's nothing like me, by the way. I was an observer, and she is a young lady who is quite in life. So she was born in, I think, 1951. I was born in 1952, so we experienced the same thing at the same time, and I was able to recall that period in my life pretty well because so many things happened in the 60s. You know, we changed music from Elvis to the Beatles and all of that sound, and we had some major traumatic events going on during that period, so it's still pretty fresh in my mind. But I did want to write about the 60s. And since I was writing about the Florine who lived by the side of the road, I was writing about her childhood. That would have been back in the 60s. So
Mm.
I found Stella to be one of the most interesting characters, despite all of Florine's efforts to demonise her as this wicked stepmother. The way that you bring her into the family's life and the way that she kind of sits there is such a nice subversion of this idea that, you know, she must be necessarily a bad person taking Carly's place.
Stella.
Yeah.
Stella taught me how to write character. This is my debut novel, and originally when I started, both the father, Lehman, and Stella were pretty stock characters. Lehman I had much more harsh. I wrote him as a much more harsh character, and I wrote Stella as a wicked stepmother. And then it very quickly became very, very boring because it gave Florine nothing to grow on and nothing to learn from, and it would have made the book very short and very predictable. Stella started out not even very attractive, just sort of a comfort for Lehman. Mm. But I decided to make her quite attractive and multi-sided and multi-dimensional. And also, I made Lehman a much kinder, more multi-dimensional man. So it gave Florine a challenge every time she would try to be nasty to one of them. Their reactions would cause the conversation and the dialogue to go in a different direction that sometimes was really surprising. And it would jolt Florine a little bit so that she would have to react in a different way and perhaps grow a little from what they had to say to her or what they didn't say to her.
Writing your first novel, were you surprised to see your characters taking on a life of their own and almost, were they dictating to you what they were going to say?
Yes, I was surprised. I was delighted to see my characters take on a life of their own. That's what you want. But the conversation became easier and easier as I got to know the characters better. And if they weren't supposed to say what they were going to say, I would just stop writing. It would just stop.
Mm.
And then I would have to back up a little bit and try to figure out what it was they were trying to say to me. There was one thing with Florine where I wanted a character to do something else besides what actually happened. And I started to type and my fingers slowed down to a crawl on the keyboard. So they pretty much dictated it, you know, unconsciously, and then it would come to the fore.
And they obviously still have a lot more to say if you're working on a sequel.
They do. She could talk until she's blue in the face.
And that's all we have time for tonight. Tonight's show can be podcast at www.2ser.com and follow the links to the final draft. Next week, I speak with Jackie Wright about her first novel, Red Dirt Talking, a novel about the stories we tell ourselves set in the northwest region of WA at the beginning of the Big Wet, when people go off the rails and there's a certain kind of madness in the air.
And I'll be speaking to Courtney Collins about her debut novel, The Burial, about Australia's last bushranger, Jesse Hickman. That's Monday at 7. Until then, thanks for listening.